Hi, I'm Elise.
I'm Matt, and welcome to Pod Wraiths, the Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. If this is your first time joining us, we're two friends watching Star Trek Deep Space Nine and sharing both our deep and irreverent thoughts on our favorite Star Trek series.
This week, we're talking about Season 6, Episode 6, Sacrifice of Angels, teleplay by Ira Steven Behr and Hans Beimler, and directed by Alan Croker. Sacrifice of Angels aired on November 3rd, 1997.
This week on Deep Space Nine, a large fleet of Federation ships heads towards Deep Space Nine to stop the Dominion from destroying the wormhole minefield. A Dominion fleet meets them in battle. Can the Defiant make it in time?
Dun, dun, dun! I love...
Here we go!
I really enjoy, human sound effects rather than like a real sound effect being like
dun, womp, dun, dun. Womp.
Yeah, it's much more fun.
Awooga.
Excuse me,
I blow up my levels.
Yeah, so I just wanted to say it was so nice to hear Majel introduce the last time on Deep Space Nine and be like, and now the conclusion. It made me really happy.
Yeah, you definitely, I think we've talked about this before, just because the station has the Cardassian computer. It's a different...
Yeah, we don't get to hear her.
It's a different actor doing the voice, right?
Yeah, we don't get to hear her. Although, I felt like the actor that is doing the computer voice, because we hear... I couldn't tell if it was a computer or if it was, like, someone actually saying, like, all Dominion personnel evacuate. Like, that felt like...
Mm-hmm.
A human person, and I was like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, it sounded like a human speaking, and I was like, okay, buddies. I've really enjoyed this arc, but I am ready for our friends to be back on the station. I don't know how you feel about that.
I mean, it's been almost 2 months. I mean, it's been longer in real time because of how we've been recording them intermittently and things like that. But it's like, this is episode 6, episode 7. Yeah. So it's been like a month and a half of...
Right? At least, yeah. So. I don't even remember if they all were like... there might have even been like a week skipped at some point. So yeah, it's been a while. I did kind of laugh because there were two times I was like, oh, a deus ex machina situation in this film. Sorry, I called it a film. In this TV show, like, first when Worf shows up, although that's not, like, really one, but then obviously everything that happens with the prophets.
Yeah.
I like it, but apparently there was a lot of criticism at the time, and Ira Steven Behr was like, like, they intentionally did this because they felt like it was made sense for the next step with, like, Sisko and his relationship with the prophets. And I thought that that was... I kind of agree with him. I don't think that this was, like, something they chose to do lightly.
Yeah, it's one of those things for me where you can tell me that it's, you know, after all the build-up, it's just literally, you know, hand-wavy away and, like...
Right.
Isn't earned, and I'd be like, yeah, okay, I get where you're coming from. And then you can also hear Ira's explanation and go, yeah, okay, I get where you're coming
from. Yeah. Like, I'm not going to discount anyone that was bothered by it. Like, I understand.
Yeah. I think, too, it also shows how DS9 is, to date, like, a different type of Star Trek show. Instead of doing the like classic Star Trek thing where it's like the unmasking of a god to be this like computer pulling things behind the scenes, like that's a very TOS plot, or some random alien pretending to be a god, like,
yeah,
oh, what's the one with Arda in TNG, right? In this episode, Sisko goes to the prophets, to the wormhole aliens, and, like, challenges them to be gods.
Yeah.
To act like gods.
They're like, if you're going to be gods,
get their fingers dirty.
Get involved here. Like, do a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, that's kind of when you put it in the context of wider Star Trek and what are the tropes of the franchise and the most Star Trek things, if you will, it seems very like the antithetical. It's like, what? It's like the opposite of what does God do to Starship?
Yes, I love that. I also, so when doing my notes for this episode, I was really amused. Memory Alpha is such a wealth of knowledge. I always am happy to read like what people have put on there. And I found out there are actually two different explanations and two different properties of like where the Dominion fleet were sent, in that big scene in the episode. And I thought it'd be really fun to share mm-hmm. those. The first one is according to a 2003 novel titled Unity, the prophets sent the Jem'Hadar fleet to like a pocket dimension. I don't remember, like, I didn't see if, like, anything came of that in that book, but I thought that was funny. And the second thing I like even more, apparently in the 2012 game Star Trek Online, the missing Jem'Hadar come out, 34 years after the Dominion War has ended, and those like Jem'Hadar people like try to take like DS9 again, and the player has to like convince them that the war is over. And I was really amused by the fact that like in some cases like those people were not convinced and you kind of have to like fight them off again.
Yeah. That's also a very Star Trek thing.
Yeah, I really enjoy that. I just imagine it'd be really funny, like, the Jem'Hadar coming out, like, 34 years, like, after the war ended and being, like... It's like when someone's in a coma in, like, a TV show or a movie and they're like,
"Yeah,
what's going... What year is this?" Like, I am amused by that heavily.
Your big While You Were Sleeping stand, then?
Oh, yes, it's my favorite film. I do... I do like it, though, if I'm being honest. It's a fun, silly movie. Because of the type of episode this is, and it ends, like, such a big arc, I kind of just did the notes in chronological order. And I think that is okay. Are you cool with that? Mm-hmm. After, not that we have a choice at this point, because that's how the notes are set up.
Yeah, no, let's lay it on me. Cannons to the left of them, cannons to the right. Let's go.
Here I am, let's stuck go. In the middle with you.
Cannons to the left of me, cannons to the right. Here I am stuck in the middle with you.
Yesterday we recorded a bonus podcast episode of Pay Attention 007 where we go over like what makes a good Bond song. And so there was a little bit of singing on that episode, and you would have been proud. I did not personally really sing, but it was great anyway.
Do you rank the themes in that episode? Does everyone reveal what their favorite theme is?
No. I mean, it's more of a conversation. We talked about what makes a good, like, what attributes make a good Bond song. And then we had a guest on, William Bibbiani, who writes for The Wrap. And he is involved in, I think he might be a movie genre person as well. He wrote about Blofeld's Cat in the summer zine for movie genre.
Yes.
This season. And which I still have yet to read. I have that. I've had that on my nightstand for like, since it came out. Anyway, so we, each of us like did our top five, and then Tessa like collaborated that and made a top five list for all of us, which of course is no one's top five, but it's like ones that we agree on. Mm-hmm. So we talked about those. Yeah. But yeah.
Nice.
And we talked about them in chronological order, so there weren't even like really ranked or anything. But A View to a Kill was on everyone's list.
Do, 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 do,
okay. Now.
Meeting you with a view to a kill. That's a case where probably the theme song is better than the actual movie, but
that is one of the cases, but I like that movie more than most. But I agree with you. The biggest movie is bad, song is good. Difference
Live
for me
and
is,
Let Die.
No, it's Diamonds Are Forever. Live and Let Die is a movie that I enjoy forever. More than
Well, way to out yourself as a racist. Holy shit. I'm just kidding.
we already recorded.
It's Jane Seymour's hair in that movie. It just really does it for you, right?
it is really Jane Seymour's hair. We've recorded that episode already, actually, so we definitely get into all the racism. Anyway, this is a Star Trek podcast. Not a James Bond podcast.
Was it matter to you? When you got a job to do, you gotta do it well. You gotta give the Dominion hell. Okay,
that was fan-fucking-tastic.
That was my segue back to...
It was phenomenal.
Star Trek.
This is why we do this podcast, specifically for those peak transitions that you're so good at. So we pick up right where we left off at the end of the last episode. Starfleet is flying towards Deep Space Nine, and Sisko is in charge of the entire fleet. I did really enjoy that every time Sisko gave an order, we had a little side conversation with Rom asking Garak what was going on, so that they can explain it to the audience, which I thought was really funny. We also have a scene where O'Brien and Bashir are reciting a poem together. That poem was "The Charge of the Light Brigade" by Alfred Lord Tennyson about the Crimean War, and it was written in 1854. I did at the end of that situation where Garak was at the end of the episode, Garak's how does that poem end? And they're you don't want to know. I don't know that poem, but I thought some people might want to know where it came from. This is not really within this part of the plot, but I did really want to take a moment and talk about the battle in this episode. This is the biggest battle that's ever been in Star Trek. That might, at least on a TV show, and that might still be the case. Actually, it is also the first Star Trek episode where for the battle they exclusively use CGI. So it was a huge project for television, and I feel they knew it was going to be a lot of work. So they actually divided the work between Digital Muse and Foundation Light Imaging, two different companies. One of them was doing the Federation ships, and one of the companies was doing the alien ships. And I think it's interesting. The Federation ships were not digitized, but the alien ships were. And then, one of the groups, I think Digital Muse, was doing the animation of the entire battle. They really didn't have an option to do a soundstage with models and motion control rigs, because of how big it was.
Too many. Yeah,
that would have been insane. I've been watching a lot of kaiju films lately, and it's really, those movies are so amazing for model work and stuff like that, and the scale of them is amazing. I've been watching them in chronological order, so it's been really awesome to see how the model work is getting even better and better, and I just think that this would have been impossible. Yeah. Even 30 years after the kaiju films, that I'm watching.
Yeah. Yeah, not to go too deep down the rabbit hole after we already went on a Bond-themed rabbit hole. They spent a lot of money, hired two digital art studios to create this battle scene. And for the majority of it, for how old it is, the CG holds up, and in some ways it looks better than a lot of things what you'd see in a major TV show or film release today. And it's not that the technology has gotten worse. It's just our expectations and where studios are cheaper and there's more crunch and don't give the artists the visual effects artists the time that they need. So it ends up looking worse than 30 years ago. And that just drives me nuts.
Yeah. I think hiring...
it's all about labor practices.
Exactly. I think hiring two different groups, knowing how to split up the work, was a really good idea. I don't think they spared expense on this. Like, you can see the money out there. Yes, I was trying to evoke. What's his face?
John Hammond.
Yes, but I was like Richard Attenborough. I couldn't remember his character name.
The voice you're now hearing is Richard Kiley.
But yeah, so I think that they did a really good job. And I also read that they had a couple of former pilots they had consulted so that the battle sequence would actually make like tactical sense. And it wasn't just like a bunch of nonsense on screen. So yeah,
I can't remember if we'd seen them before, but this might be the first opportunity we had to see like Federation, like a fighter wing. It was like, you know, being the smaller kind of snub
fighters seeing those as opposed fighters. To the
big capital ships. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't remember seeing those before, but yeah, after Sisko is like giving his plans out to the fleet, we cut to Tarek Nor with Dukat, Damar, Weyoun, and the female changeling kind of discussing what Sisko's doing. Dukat is extremely cocky throughout this entire episode. He thinks that he's very smart and that he sees what Sisko's doing. Like, oh, they're trying to rile up the Cardassian ships because they want us to leave our posts and give them an in to come towards us. And he like does this thing where Weyoun's like looking and he like challenges Weyoun. Like, do you know what Sisko's doing? Cause he thinks that Weyoun's an idiot. And it's really unclear if Weyoun is grasping what the plan is, but it doesn't really matter because Dukat's going to tell him anyway. But yeah, the two of them have been going back and forth like all season, and it's been like it almost comes to a head here in this episode, even though, you know, by the end of the episode, Dukat is obviously like on his own little journey. Damar, who has been dealing with all of Dukat's like personal issues with like Zial, which is kind of, I think we've said it's like inappropriate. Like, that's not his job. He wants to go after all of Ram's associates. And Dukat reminds them like him, like, oh, let's just hold them. Like, if we arrest them, the Pajor will be really upset because it's like without cause. And I think that's funny that later, that's kind of forgotten. And later the female changeling is like, oh yeah, Kira's going to be put to death. But yeah, that's getting ahead of myself. They also want to put Zial like in court quarters, and he tells Dukat that he doesn't trust her. And I do feel like this is really the splintering of Dukat and Damar's relationship. It starts here.
Damar. Damar. This is, yeah.
Yeah.
Damar's so interesting to me. And I can get why if folks are watching for the first time, it's just like, yeah, whatever. He's just like a henchman. But
yeah,
we'll see what happens now that he's divorced from Dukat. Right?
Yes.
And
yeah.
I don't know. Can he come back from murdering Zial? Maybe. Maybe not. Probably not. We'll never forget. Like,
It's hard to tell. We'll find out. There's a lot of... throughout this episode, there's a lot of back and forth. Like, we're seeing the Defiant. We're seeing the battle. We're seeing the station. We're seeing ops. So, I know that's a lot of back and forth. And sometimes the scene will be, like, for 1 minute or whatever. But Sisko knows that this is, like, a trap and decides to, like, be like, fuck it, we're doing it anyway. And continue. Like, because Sisko just keeps continuing on in this entire episode. Dukat is like prematurely celebrating, which is very interesting. He's basically walking around with like a whiskey glass, and Weyoun is like, what are you doing? And Dukat accuses Weyoun of being joyless, which I think is really funny because I don't think Weyoun is probably built to be joyful, but I also think like Weyoun is like, you're also just being really short-sighted right now.
Yeah.
There's an interesting conversation between Wei-Yun and Dukat where Wei-Yun starts to talk to him about the Bajoran occupation. And Dukat is, like, extremely creepy in how he talks about the Bajorans. I protected so many of them. I treated them like they were my children. But he also has a very, like, I was just following orders, not implementing things, which is, like, I mean, he doesn't phrase it that way, but it has that kind of vibe. Wei-Yun also mentions that he thinks Earth is the key to taking over the Federation. And Dukat goes on this, like, rant about how you win by making your opponent realize they were wrong to oppose you. And then you force them to acknowledge your greatness. And I'm just like, this dude is so far up his own ass. Like, he doesn't even know what he's talking about anymore, I don't think. He's a little bit manic in this episode because I'm not saying it's like without cause that causes him to go so low later in the episode, but he's so high right now. It's just wild. Like he actually is like, I protected them, but do you see a statue of me on Bajor? And I'm just like, you are a delusional motherfucker.
Under no circumstances do you have to hand it to him, but Mark Alano is really good in this episode.
Oh, totally. He's great in it. He's really great. I think he's really good in this character most of the time. Like, he really... Mm-hmm. Mark Alano, like, becomes scary because of how good he is playing Dukat. There's also a bunch of stuff going on with, like, Odo and the female changeling. Like, she comes to tell him that the battle's going well, and Odo is, like, admitting to her that he's told himself the link is more important than his friends and what's going on, but he just can't believe it. And then she brings up Kira and how Kira does not deserve your loyalty. And this whole scene to me reads as, like, you can't let your friend stop you from being an oppressor and having oppressive ideas. Like, it reminds me of people who are like, oh, we're getting so criticized for our, like, shitty racist or transphobic views, but, like, we're so nice to these other people. And it's like, yeah, you're being treated shitty because you have shitty views, not because, like, there's things that people can agree on, can agree to disagree, and there's things that are not able to be agree to disagree. And I think that...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just very... It's just very weird. But yeah, this is the same scene where she tells Odo that Kira's been arrested, this is the part where I was like, earlier they said they weren't going to arrest them, but now it's an arrest. Like, I thought that might have just been like a continuity error, actually.
No, they were arresting them, but like the official story was hold for, you can't see me doing scare quotes or air quotes, but it's like hold for questioning. It's, yeah.
That turns into a arrest. And the changeling lady is like, her death will be your salvation. Like, you'll be able to forget about her when she's dead. She's such a drama queen.
I mean, so is Odo kind of too. So maybe, in the same way that fascism is genetically coded in the founders, being messy bitches is also part of them being dramatic. They have no emotional regulation because their brains are goo.
They are goo brains. When we were watching this episode this week, or because I rewatched it this morning, but we were talking, we being me and the roommates, about how Deep Space, unlike the other Star Trek shows that take place on mostly on ships, this show does not really have like a hotshot, cocky helms person. You know, on Strange New Worlds, we have Erica. On Discovery, we had Detmer. We had Sulu, was awesome on TOS. And, like, this just doesn't have somebody like that. But I do think that over the series, whenever they do need really good maneuvering, Dax is at the helm. Even though she's mostly like a science person, I think she is a great person to have at the helm, and she would be my choice for like best helms person in this crew.
It's like, do you want to get us through the line? I'd certainly like to try.
Worf shows up for just like a, oh, hey, remember Worf wasn't here? We got the rest of the Klingons. So yeah, Worf brings more Klingon folks. Because I think we last left him and... wow, my brain.
Martok?
Thank you. Apologies. I love you, Martok. I'm so sorry. They had left to go.
Garon didn't want to send the troops.
Yes, yeah. That part I remember.
They were supposed to be part of it, but yeah.
They keep giving us like a time, like a countdown throughout this episode. Like at this point, we have 3 hours until the Dominion's planning to blow the mines up. Later, we have 40 minutes left. Like there's a very 11
we have
minutes,
2 minutes
out.
Left.
Yeah, there's a lot of like countdown, which actually I think adds to the tension of this episode really well. I think the Dominion fucks up at this exact point in the episode. Weyoun wants their forces to follow the Defiant because the Defiant actually gets through all of the Dominion lines, and Dukat is like, nah, we'll just beat them when they arrive here with the station. And I think this is really just like where they fuck up, because if they had gotten the Defiant now, I don't think that their plan would have worked.
Yeah. Yep. No, 100%. And like, you can see how hindsight is 20/20, et cetera, but that was the strategic misstep that kind of leads to the Deus Ex Machina, right?
Yes, exactly. All of our friends, except for Quark, on the station are in custody. So Quark actually reaches out to Zial, and he, like, does this, like, he surprises her. But I do like that she immediately knows that she's safe with him. Like, she, like, he needs her to make, like, a food diversion so that they can, like, have the security guard outside of the jail, like, look at it. And like, Zial's gonna hypo spray him and knock him out.
That was such a good bit that I enjoyed, because like they make it seem like it's the
food has something
nail
inside
file
of it.
And the cake, right?
Yeah.
It's
exactly.
Like that, and it's like we just want to distract them. So we
yeah,
can
it's great. Him. It's really good. There is also a bit of comedy when Zial and Quark like go into the jail and Quark is like, don't move, to like the Jem'Hadar people, and then he's like, one of you like do the force field thing, and Zial has to be like, you told them not to move. which is really funny because Quark just shoots both of them anyway, and then he's so shocked that he did it that Kira has to like remind him to let like fuck up the force field to let them out. So I thought that was really funny. And I love that Rom and Kira are like, we're going to continue this mission. Y'all need to hide. Because Rom and Kira are the fucking heroes. I think
there's actually a lot of, now that I think about it, there's a lot of like, oh, and now they get rescued because of this, like the Klingons. And like, oh, Odo had to change your heart. Here he is with all his deputies. Like, yeah.
Yeah. So I think between finding out that Kira was going to be sentenced to death and the next time we see him, I think Odo has already changed his mind on what he's doing here, because he's talking to the female changeling when Weyoun comes in to be like, hey, all the prisoners escaped. And Weyoun's like, come to Ops, you'll be the safest there. And Odo is like, oh, I'll be fine here. And I'm actually, I have to assume that the female changeling knows that Odo's changed his mind at this point.
Yeah.
And it's probably like, we kind of lost him temporarily. So but she's not going to fight with one of her own. So she kind of lets it happen, I think.
Yep.
Yeah, so as you alluded to, Kira and Rom are like fighting their way through. They're trying to destroy the weapons still so that they can't... So the Dominion can't destroy the mines. and they're kind of pinned down, but Rom hears like a bunch of Bajoran weapons because he has good ears. And we see Odo coming out with the rest of the Bajoran security, and they've taken everyone out. It's 40 minutes left, and Odo has officially changed sides. And I do appreciate a little bit of the scene where Kira is like, I could ask you why. And he's like, I don't have time to like, we don't have time for that right now.
But then he's also like, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. She says, what about the link? And he's like, the link was paradise, but it appears I'm not ready for paradise. I don't know that I like this response. I think saying the link was paradise covers a lot of ground enough to be like, yeah, I was being manipulated and it was so perfect that I like couldn't leave it. Like, that makes sense to me. But the I'm not ready for paradise implies like I may go back there later, which, you know, could happen. But I also feel like it was just I've said this before, but like if I was Kira, I would be like, OK, you're helping me now, but we're still done. We are not friends anymore still.
Yeah, and even just right before that, when he's like, we don't have time to explain, but I think you know why. Yeah. It's like, oh, this is all about her and how he feels about her, right?
Yes. Like, yes, yes, yes. The Defiant is 11 minutes out. Kira's given Rom a pep talk about cutting the weapon systems. And I just really love, like, because Rom is, like, so nervous. He just wants to get it done. And she's so good under pressure. I really enjoy Rom and Kira's scenes in the last, like, few.
So we cut back to Ops. And Dukat is still set on his impending victory.
Yes.
Of the Dominion fleet coming through the wormhole. All of the mines have the self-replicating has been neutralized. And they're ready to detonate. And it succeeds.
Yeah.
Rom is too late with the weapon shut off. Happens just like that millisecond too late.
Yep.
So the Defiant arrives as soon as the mines start going off, and Sisko says, take us into the wormhole. At that point, Dukat, Wayun, and Ko and Ops are like, hey, let's take out the Defiant.
Yep.
But Rom did succeed in disabling the weapons just a little bit too late. And at this point,
yeah,
it kind of reminded me of one of the scenes in Andor, which I won't go into because of spoilers.
Well, but I've personally finished all of Andor, so people can fast forward if you want to get into it.
Yeah, no, it's just the idea of like every little act of resistance can like further like the cause. So it's like, yeah, Rom failed to prevent the minefield being taken down, but he ended up the opposite of war isn't peace, it's creation.
Oh my god, I've been so listening to that lately, by the way. We'll talk later.
But the Defiant's able to enter the wormhole and have their spiritual experience and get the prophets into the war because the weapons were disabled, right? Yep. And then the weapons are still disabled later after the fleet, the reinforcements don't arrive, and the Federation starts coming and has broken the line. So they're all coming at signals the Dominion retreat. So really, Rom and Kira had a big part in liberating the station. They just failed to destroy the mines, right?
Yeah.
So,
what did you think about the Defiant going into the mines and then the prophets kind of taking over? As usual, they are represented by people that Sisko knows in real life.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was funny that Dukat was one of those people, and I'm like, they got Mark Alamo for this episode. They might as well use him for this scene.
Use him, yeah. Same with Casey Biggs as Damar and Jeffrey Combs as Wayun.
Yes, the prophets refer to Sisko's life as a game that cannot end right now. So Sisko interprets it as like, okay, well, you don't want me to die, so like, save us. Maybe you should help us defeat the Dominion fleet that's, like, literally in this wormhole, like, with us right now.
Yeah.
And they claim not to be they don't want to get involved with corporeal matters. And he's like, well, that's bullshit because I'm of Bajor, you're of Bajor. Like, come on, do me a solid here, please. He asks for a miracle and they're like, they finally agree, but they're like, we will do it for a price. Because earlier in the season, Sisko was telling Admiral how he wants to not retire, but he wants to build a house on Bajor and live there. He's like, I will go anywhere that Starfleet tells me for my job, but Bajor is where I'm going to call home. And the prophets are like, you're not going to be able to settle on Bajor when you're done. So it very much feels like once you're done with your job here, like your life's going to be ours. That's how I'm reading this. Like you won't have, the price is you will have to do what we say or we're not done with you yet. Benjamin Sisko.
Yeah. It's the cost. It's like the surrender. It's like meeting at the crossroads and selling your soul to the devil to be the best guitar player. Right. It reminds me a little bit, and I only really watched like the first season, but of Once Upon a Time, and there's like the Rumpelstiltskin character, and so it's like, Magic has a price!
Yes, I've only seen the first season of that as well.
Magic has a price!
So this is where we get our real deus ex machina. Sisko leaves the prophets, and they're... Bye, guys! Nice knowing you. And the Dominion fleet has disappeared, like thousands of them just gone. Like O'Brien thinks maybe they cloaked, and Dax is like, I actually don't sense any ships nearby. They're just gone. And then it's really fun to see the other side of this, like the everyone that's in ops, like Ducat and company, like seeing the wormhole open up and the Defiant come through, and they think that the Defiant's going to be followed by their like thousands of ships, but like the wormhole just closes again. There's no ships behind them, and Ducat starts losing his shit at this point. The Defiant is firing on the ship on the station, which has like no weapons, and 200 Starfleet ships are on their way. So the Dominion is cutting their losses and leaving Tarek Nor. And Ducat so dramatically is like, victory was within our grasp. Maybe you shouldn't have had your whiskey early, buddy.
Yeah, it's just when he cheers himself. And then,
What a tool. But he wants to, so Ducat is like, I have to find my daughter and get us out of here. And Damar's like, what are you even talking about? Like, Zial's not going to go with you. And I think it's funny that, I mean, Damar's right, but we don't really see where Damar's going. We just know later he has clearly followed Ducat. But we do have a scene where we cut to the Defiant and Sisko is like, they're fleeing. And then he's like, tell everyone to rendezvous at Deep Space Nine. And it's like very nice to be like, everyone back at the station. And it makes my heart happy. While the Dominion personnel are evacuating, Wei Yun says to the female changeling, what about Odo? Is he coming with us? And she says, no, but he will join us one day. It's only a matter of time. And I'm just like, okay, lady. That's the part where I felt like she knew early. That comment is why I think earlier she knew that he was going to turn on. The episode has a very dramatic ending with, Ducat and Zial. He catches up with her, or they find each other, and she tells him that she's not, like, he just assumes she's coming with him, and she tells him that she's not. She admits that she helped the resistance and that she's one of them. She's like, these are my friends and I'm staying here with them. And this conversation goes on for a bit and she's leaving and he runs back to her to, like, you know, say one last goodbye kind of. And Damar, who we don't see, he's out of the shot, shoots her from afar, overhearing their conversation. So Damar is like, oh, she is a traitor to us, so I must kill her. It's very tragic. I don't care about Ducat losing his daughter. I only care about, like, Zial as a character dying. I think it's very sad because, like, she finally... I think she had wrestled since coming on the show with who she was as a person, where her allegiances are to, are like a line, what society she feels comfortable in. And I think she finally found friends and family, and now she's dead.
I really wish I knew more about the decision to kill her character. Because it's like, was it like, because her arc was, they felt like her arc was done and they couldn't do anything interesting. Is it like...
Right. I think it would have been fine to just have her be a character on the show, just like having lunch with Garrick sometimes, like that, and Kira. You don't need to do more than that.
The Garrick thing too. But yes, yeah,
but if they're going in that direction anyway, I mean.
And it's, I don't know. It's... They wanted to have some other, or I feel like they wanted to have some other big emotional loss to really, like, bring Ducat to his lowest after not only the defeat and loss of the station a second time, but to have it all with, like, Zial because his other family has banded him and all of this stuff. And it's just like...
Do you think we could call it a fridging?
That's what I'm dancing around, and I don't want to, like...
It's hard, because she did have her own motivation. She had her art that she was really into. But at the same time, like, the actual death part feels like it was just put there to, like, make him go off the rails a bit.
Yeah, that's... That's exactly what I was... I guess kind of dancing around, because I didn't want to, like,
I'm not gonna call it, you know, that's what I'm gonna say, like, I'm not gonna call it that, but I think that I think it's fair to not call it a fridging, but also say that we are discussing whether we think it could be a fridging or not. Like, you're like, is it one, is it not one? That's an interesting conversation to have regardless of whether where we land on it. So
yeah.
That's why I'm just like, I'm going to just say this word.
It just fucking sucks.
It really does.
Sucks.
I'm sad for everyone. I'm sad for Kira. Our friends all meet on Deep Space Nine. Jake and Sisko hug. Do we know how long it's been since they left the station? Like, in universe time?
Probably a series of months. I don't know how many.
Because I truly do not feel that Jake and Benjamin hugged for long enough. If I hadn't seen my parents in, like, my dad in months, and it was because of this type of event, we'd be hugging for, like, 10 minutes. I think it's really funny how everyone kind of reacts to... We're back on the station. O'Brien and Bashir... I, like, wrote the wrong name in my notes... immediately are like, let's play Battle of Britain in the holosuite. And I'm like, dudes, like, go take a fucking nap. Or, like, do a sexy holosuite. Yeah. Like,
yeah,
don't, not a battle one. Like, that is actually a little deranged. And I think it makes no sense.
A little bit, right? Yeah.
I did love Nog, Rom, and Lita all, like, reuniting. I love their family, and it was really nice to give them a scene. And I loved that Nog is going to be working in engineering, because, like, that's, like, kind of he's been working under O'Brien. And I love that Nog is like, I might be your boss, to his dad. We overhear... Well, Garrick overhears Jake tell Sisko that Kira is in the infirmary with Zial. So Garrick goes looking for her. And it is really sad. Like, regardless of what their relationship was, they were at least friends. And I think that they are allowed to be friends, and they cared about each other as friends, at least. And it just is really sad to see Garrick over her dead body. I mean, Kira throws in a "she loved you," which I think is bizarre. But you can, I mean, I love you, Matt. So, like, we can just say that it was a friend thing. We can pretend. But, yeah, it's just, it was just sad because everyone's having their reunions with their people that they hang out with the most that they haven't seen in a long time. And Garrick, and Garrick's looking for her and has no one. Exactly. And that is just sad. At least he still has. And at the end of the episode, we see Dukat in a holding cell, rambling to himself, thinking he's talking to Zial and saying, I forgive you and all of that. And then he sees Sisko. And he says to Sisko as he hands him his baseball back, like, I forgive you too, which is kind of funny because, like, I don't think Sisko needed his forgiveness. and Ryan says
something. But it's a moment of, like, semi-lucidity, though, right? That he recognizes, like, he thinks he's talking to Zial and he's, like, obviously broken, but, like, he recognizes that it is Sisko. That's Sisko, like, it's a moment of lucidity.
And then my roommate Ryan said something that I found really funny. He goes, I think whomever holds the baseball controls the station. Like, he, like, gives him the baseball back and Sisko's now in charge again. That was and thus a lot.
Yeah. And thus concludes the first serialized arc of episodes of Deep Space Nine. What's interesting, and I think this is the right call, the Dominion War is not over.
Correct.
It will continue. Originally, Rick Berman, just when he let them do the war and finally acquiesced to the desire to do the Dominion War, he wanted it over in the 6-episode arc, and they said, no, we're good. We can't just do that. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see as we go forward how the show balances that with, you know, the more kind of monster of the week sort of episode of the week shows as well, which we're now we're able to do because we can have a little bit more of a status return to the status quo.
This new status quo is we're at war, but we're still at least all on the station. I say we're because we're obviously part of the Deep Space Nine crew.
Oh, 100%, right?
Yeah.
100%.
What if we were doing this podcast about our coworkers? Like, we're like Lower Decks and we're just like, they'd probably, it'd be really funny to like, if they found out of us. Odo would probably have to keep an eye on us because we're constantly like, what the fuck, Odo?
That actually would be like would have been a good Lower Decks bit where you have like someone from like Beta Shift, like not in our like main characters, but it's like they're doing about, like a current events podcast about like what Cerritos they think the cast. Senior officers are up to.
Yeah. Cerritos cast. That's really funny.
This Cerritos life. Now it's time for the Altair Water Thirst Quencher. Altair Water first being mentioned in the context of Star Trek in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock by Dr. McCoy. Also a possible reference to Alta from Altair 4 in the MGM film Forbidden Planet. Elise, who are you thirsting for this week?
I didn't really have a thirsting in this episode, to be honest. What about you?
I mean, I'm not a Republican, so I am not super horny for war, so I don't really either. But we did get that moment at the end where everyone's getting reunited, and Worf and Jadzia are reunited, and she's like, well, I guess the wedding's still on. So that was, I think, the closest. It wasn't a particular thirsty moment, but that was the closest.
Yeah. Which, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that we're very close to the wedding. I'm excited. Like, it's coming up. It's coming up next.
So it's an intentional palate cleanser after this arc.
Yes, I think that was
it. Might even
call.
Be as soon as the next episode.
Yes, exactly.
What's your nominee for the most Star Trek thing?
I think that my most Star Trek thing is that they innovated so much with this episode by having this huge battle and real, you know, I just think doing something new is my most Star Trek thing. Like, I can't even compare it to other Star Treks. And I think that that is the answer. The fact that it's doing something new for the series. That might have been a cop-out answer, but that's okay.
No, I don't think so. Like, mine is kind of the idea of, like, the happy ending. We just talked about, we're not fully reset to the status quo because the war is like continuing on and everything else. But we're back to resembling, it's not a major shakeup anymore. It's kind of like the end of Best of Both Worlds because Patrick Stewart did come back, right?
Yeah. So. After family.
Yeah.
My favorite episode. Awesome.
All right. Well, until next time, Elise, where can folks find more of you on the internet?
You can find me on Blue Sky, Letterboxd, and Storygraph at Chicken Tendi. That's T-N-D-I. You can find links to Fang Bangers Pod, my True Blood podcast, on Blue Sky and Instagram at Fang Bangers Pod. That's bangers with a Z or Z. And we, by the time this episode comes out, I think we may either have one or two more episodes of season 6 coming out of that show. So we only have one more season to go, to be recorded. You can also find links to my James Bond podcast, Pay Attention 007, on Blue Sky and Instagram at Pay Attention 007 Pod and at MovieJawn.com. That's JAWN. When this is being recorded, we just released our episode on Diamonds Are Forever. I'm not entirely sure if this will come out before or after our Sean Connery wrap-up, which is the following episode.
I'm excited to listen to the Diamonds Are Forever episode because it's a weird movie, man.
We were pretty harsh on it, I will admit.
Even though it does star Crispin Glover's dad, it's a weird movie.
Yes, exactly. He's one of the better
parts. Howard Hughes things, like yeah.
I actually think that Crispin Glover's dad is part of the better parts. I love my gay henchmen more and more each time.
I'm sure you guys talked about it, but it's one of those things where like this is problematic, but also it kind of rules.
Yeah, I think it's only problematic because there's not a lot of gay people in James Bond. I think if there were, then it would be fine. But yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, where can we find you online?
Yeah, you can catch me on Blue Sky and Letterboxd at Maddie Hugh. You can also catch me writing a little bit about mostly film, but some TV on MovieJawn.com as well. And by the time this comes out, my piece on the 5th anniversary of the premiere of Star Trek Lower Decks should be out because I have to submit it by Friday.
Oh, I can't wait to read that. I'm half written. Excited.
So yeah, it's kind of going to be looking at Lower Decks kind of in its totality, a little bit about the history of streaming, where we're at now, and the idea of fandom and common shared languages and community, and why people responded more positively to Lower Decks when it came out than Discovery's, a little bit mixed reactions. And
interesting. Well,
the
definitely
good reasons and maybe the not so good reasons that existed.
Yeah. Well, definitely, I'll definitely be posting that on our feed when it comes out for sure, because it's your writing and it's Star Trek related.
Right? There you go. My first TV John feature.
Nice.
So there we go. You can also catch Elise and I together at Blue Sky and Instagram at PodRace. And you can email us at podrace@gmail.com.
Please remember to rate and review us on the podcatching system of your choice. Thank you again to our editor, Melissa, and to DJ Empirical for our Interstellar theme song.
And until next time, computer and program.
Bye.